Marvin Olney back with To The Point. The U.S. is expected to lose 200,000 jobs this month, and unemployment, now 6.1%, could rise to 7 or 8%. General Electric, Whirlpool, Xerox, Coca-Cola, Merck, and Yahoo, big-name companies, are laying people off. So are most of the airlines. But the auto industry is being hit hardest of all. Cars are not selling. Unemployment in Michigan has already reached 9%. Bernard Simon covers the auto industry for the Financial Times. And Bernard Simon, welcome to our program.
Hi, Warren.
That sounds grim.
It is grim indeed. And it's probably going to get grimmer. We just heard last week Chrysler say that they're going to cut a quarter of their white-collar workforce, and that alone is 5,000 people.
What about the ripple effect from the auto industry? It isn't just cars that are affected.
Absolutely. You know, most people tend to think of the auto industry as being General Motors, Ford, Toyota, Chrysler, etc. But behind those companies are, number one, a large number of suppliers who make all the parts that go into a car. You know, the average car has about 14,000 parts in it, and somebody has to produce those. And then, of course, at the other end of the chain are people like dealers, and these folks are also suffering badly. Companies like Delphi, which is North America's biggest parts maker, have laid off thousands and thousands of workers in the last few years.
I've seen it estimated that if one of the big three were to go bankrupt, the impact could be a million jobs. Is that an overstatement?
We won't know until it happens, to be honest. But, you know, the chances of it being that high, I doubt whether it would frankly be that high, because, you know, some of whichever car maker it was as operations would be absorbed by the others. But it would still be devastating. I mean, of that there's no doubt at all.
If Chrysler and General Motors were to merge, there's now a lot of talk about that, what would the impact of that be? Would jobs still be lost?
Jobs would almost certainly be lost. Chrysler at the moment employs about 65,000 people, and some estimates are that about half of those people would go in a merger. The problem is that Chrysler and GM have a lot of overlapping products. You know, many of their pickup trucks, their SUVs, that sort of thing are very similar. They'd have far too many brands. They'd have far too many dealers. You'd certainly find thousands of dealers having to go out of business. And all that would obviously take a toll.
I understand General Motors needs capital in order to keep going. Chrysler has capital. That's the rationale behind the merger. Does that sound right?
Well, not really.
Okay.
Neither of them has much money at the moment. The problem is that both of them are running short of cash very rapidly. You know, car sales, just as your previous speaker was saying, consumer sentiment is really low. People are just not buying cars at the moment, which means that companies like GM and Chrysler are having to cut production all the time, but at the same time their car plants are there, they're having to pay a lot of workers, and their cash is running very low. And, you know, there's a fear that both of them could, in effect, run out of cash by, you know, roughly this time next year, and they have to do something about it.
Are we looking at the end of the auto industry in the United States, at least with American companies?
We're not looking at the end of the auto industry, but we're looking at a transformation in the auto industry. You know, something's about to change. The likelihood is that at least one of the Detroit car makers is going to be swallowed up by one of the others. You know, and some of it will probably disappear altogether. So you'll find fewer car makers. You're going to find just a whole new competitive landscape out there.
The White House is and the Congress both, of course, are looking at this. The White House with the idea of helping the merger of Chrysler and GM. There apparently are some issues that having to do with their access to the $700 billion bailout money. They may or may not be able to get that, may have to take it through their financial arms rather than the manufacturing arms. And Congress is looking at a stimulus package. What do you think is needed in that context to rescue this industry?
Well, clearly what it feels it needs is money, but ultimately what it needs is to produce cars that people want to buy. You know, in the last couple of years, the three Detroit car makers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, have done pretty well in cutting costs, but they're not yet producing the cars that people want to buy. They've been losing market share, and that ultimately is going to be their true salvation.
What about the idea that the auto companies have been badly managed and are just going to have to take their licks? Is this industry too big to fail?
It looks like it. You know, right now, as you say, lawmakers in Washington are getting involved, and the auto industry is certainly making the case that, you know, the ripple effects of one of the companies going down would be so great, especially in states like Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, that, you know, public policy demands that something be done about it. I mean, it is a very, very large employer, as I say, not only the car makers themselves and not only the parts makers, but if you think of people like advertising agencies, event management companies, the list goes on and on of people who provide services to this industry.
We're talking with Bernard Simon. You're the covering the automotive industry in North America for the Financial Times. Is what's happening in the auto industry symptomatic of other parts of the economy?
I think it is, because consumer sentiment is very low. People are loath to spend at the moment. And, of course, autos are a big-ticket item, so they don't spend on those. But, you know, it applies to other things as well, houses being another obvious example. But, you know, in the process, one's seeing that sales of all sorts of things are going down. One of your earlier guests mentioned Whirlpool. I mean, people don't want to buy domestic appliances and don't have the means to buy domestic appliances as they did, you know, a few months and a few years ago. They're being very much more cautious with their money, and that, of course, affects just about everything.
Again, Bernard Simon is a Financial Times correspondent specializing in the automotive industry. We're going to talk further about the possibility of a stimulus package and also other kinds of assistance to that industry and other industries as well. First, let's talk a little bit about the effect of unemployment itself. Barbara Ehrenreich is a journalist. She's recent author of This Land Is Their Land, Reports from a Divided Nation. She also wrote the national bestseller Nickel and Dimed or Not, Getting By in America. Barbara Ehrenreich, welcome to our program.
Oh, glad to be with you, Warren.
We heard a moment ago about consumer confidence at its lowest point since the Consumer Board has been trying to keep track of it. What do you think's going on here, and what are the implications going to be for American workers?
Well, I think we're just beginning to see the effects on, quote, Main Street, you know, which is so funny that we have to distinguish anyway between Main Street and Wall Street. It's not one economy. But, you know, so far we've been watching these crazy changes, gyrations in the stock market. But the next wave is layoffs. That's what's beginning to hit now, rising unemployment. And it's in all kinds of companies. You expect, like in banking and real estate and the auto industry, but also PepsiCo, Merck, just, you know, a tremendous, any kind of company you can imagine is laying people off.
You have written about income inequality in the United States and what that means to the country. Is this situation going to be exaggerated by layoffs?
Well, that's hard to say right now. I just don't know what the class contours of America are going to be if we go into a deep recession. So we seem to have the super rich. They're still there. I mean, if you were a billionaire and you lost 30% of that, you know, you're going to get by somehow, right? But, you know, what is going to happen, it's what's happening to the middle class and the poor is something else. And, of course, foreclosures have been a big part of it, foreclosures and evictions. Evictions of people who were tenants didn't know that their landlord had been foreclosed on, and then the sheriff comes and throws them out.
So are we looking at a situation different from what we have seen before since the Great Depression, do you think?
I think this is this is the first situation like this of my lifetime, and I wasn't around for the Great Depression. You know, when I wrote Nickel and Dimed, and I finished that research in 2000, I was writing about the working poor, or actually about my experiences trying to make a living on entry-level jobs. And at that point, you could get those jobs. You know, you could walk in off the street, get a job at Walmart or Best Buy or all sorts of places. Low paid, lousy benefits, everything else, but you could at least get a job. Now what I've been hearing from people in the last year, even before the current meltdown, has been like from professionals who were laid off from their white-collar jobs say, I tried to get a job just at $8 an hour, but there aren't any anymore. See, we've even had layoffs in the retail sector, which was, you know, has been strong for decades.
Bernard Simon, still with us with the Financial Times. We were talking earlier about white-collar workers at Chrysler. Do you agree with Barbara Ehrenreich that this is an issue or this is a situation that is reaching into all classes in the United States?
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, all these people have to go and find jobs. And as you were saying earlier, the unemployment rate now in Michigan is 8.7%. What do you do? There's only so many jobs in that state, and you know, frankly, a lot of people are moving to other parts of the country in the hopes of finding jobs there. But when the whole economy is tanking, well, it's more difficult for everybody.
So, Barbara Ehrenreich, back to you. What do you think is the best we can hope for in terms of some sort of government assistance?
Well, so far the government has been helping the banks, the insurance industry maybe next, the auto industry, but there's been nothing for the average person facing calamitous things like seeing their 401k shrink just as they approach retirement or losing their home and their job. Nothing. So what I would like to see is if the Democrats get it together for another economic stimulus package, that they do it in some more targeted way than just a check for everybody. You know, that they start looking at who's hurting the most and how do we help them. The people who have lost their homes, lost their jobs, we need to extend unemployment insurance. Well, we need to have had health insurance, like years ago, but it's tiresome saying that. But we need, immediate. We may need to go back to a 1930s sort of thing of having the government generate jobs, like in infrastructure repair and development.
Again, Barbara Ehrenreich, most recently, is author of This Land Is Their Land, Reports from a Divided Nation. Jared Bernstein is senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. He was formerly with the Department of Labor during the Clinton administration, recently testified before Congress about the possibility of a stimulus bill. And Jared Bernstein, it's good to have you back on our program.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
What are the prospects of getting the kind of stimulus bill out of the Congress that Barbara Ehrenreich just described? That's pretty much what you suggested yourself.
Funny how great minds think alike. That's a compliment to me. I'm not sure about her. The prospects are good, and I'd say somewhere between good and very good. Recently, I took note that Dana Perino, who is President Bush's press secretary, gave a kind of a mild thumbs up in a press conference. The Bush administration had been opposing a second stimulus package. She said the president's now interested in having that discussion, and that's important because if he wasn't, even in lame duck, that is in between the election of either President McCain or Obama, and the new president taking office during the lame duck session, he could veto it, and that would slow things down. That said, it's not clear that the Democrats would get the stimulus package they want, and I would argue the economy needs, with the current composition of the Congress, the administration, compared to what might be the case after November 4th.
So, are we talking about the possibility of a stimulus package enacted by the current Congress between November 4th and the 20th of January?
Well, my prediction is that maybe. My prediction is this. I think that, remember, this package has a number of different moving parts. For example, state fiscal relief or extending unemployment insurance compensation. I think that between November 4th and when the new president takes over in January, the Congress will extend unemployment insurance benefits and the president will sign it. That's critically important because you've got literally hundreds of thousands, 800,000 people exhausting their unemployment insurance benefits precisely for the reasons the other guests have talked about, the hiring freeze out there, and people can't find work. So they're exhausting their unemployment insurance benefits, and they desperately need those checks.
So you'd extend it. You wouldn't raise unemployment benefits, but rather extend them.
Well, that's a good question. In my testimony, I advocated both the extension and a higher benefit rate as well.
Jared Bernstein, again, a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. We're going to take a very brief break with Jared Bernstein, Barbara Ehrenreich, and others. I want to thank Bernard Simon, the Financial Times correspondent covering the automotive industry in North America, for being with us during the first half of our program. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney back with To the Point. Talk today about unemployment. We've been hearing some very unsettling figures. 200,000 people unemployed this month alone. 800,000 who have exhausted their unemployment benefits. It's likely we just heard that the Congress will pass, President Bush will sign an extension of unemployment benefits from there for them. 9% unemployment in Michigan. Other parts of the country hard hit as well, though, not just the auto industry. Terry Neese is a distinguished fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis. That's a nonpartisan and think tank in Dallas. She formerly served as president of the National Association of Women Business Owners, was the founder of Women Impacting Public Policy, organization with 550,000 members. Terry Neese, good to have you on our program today.
Good to be with you.
What do you say to what we have heard already from Jared Bernstein and Barbara Ehrenreich about the need for a targeted stimulus package in order to deal with some of the people who are facing job losses?
Well, I have a number of things that I might put out there, some already discussed and perhaps some new ones. I am a small business owner myself, and I'm actually in the human resources business. So and I've been in that business for about 30 years. So I know a thing or two about what's going on with the job market, and we might talk about that a little bit later. I do think in terms of a stimulus package that sending everybody a check is not the way to go. I just don't see that there would be any ongoing benefit to that. I also think that a cut in the marginal tax rate would help the economy. An announcement that Congress would not remove the Bush tax cuts. You almost have to hate to say Bush right now, but it's important for small business owners to not have any additional taxes on their shoulders. And so It's vitally important to small business owners that Congress not remove the current tax cuts.
People, I think, know what the Bush tax cuts are. When you talk about the marginal tax rate, what's that?
Well, the marginal rate has to do with your full tax cut, and the marginal rate and making sure that the cut in the marginal tax rate is extremely beneficial to me as a small business owner.
Okay, the Bush tax cuts are often said to have been principally for those in the upper, or the talk about cutting, restoring taxes. Let me put it that way. Tax cuts made by President Bush is principally, as far as Senator Obama is concerned, about those that are making more than $250,000 a year. He has said that again and again. Do you feel that that would be a bad thing to do?
Here's the concern that most small business owners have about that. Their chief concern is, if you're talking about $250,000 now, what keeps you from looking at $150,000 a year from now, or maybe $100,000 2 years from now? And by the way, there's been a lot of talk about only 2% of small business owners make $250,000. But you know what? The other 98% are trying to get there. So I think right now we need to be doing everything we can do to help those 98% of small business owners make that $250,000 a year.
Terry Neese, a distinguished fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis. Back to Barbara Ehrenreich. You have written about, again, the impact of income inequality on classes in the United States. You mentioned that word earlier on our a program. Where does this kind of discussion get us in terms of holding Americans together rather than separating one class from another?
Well, I didn't separate the classes. I won't take the blame here. Yes, I think some of the things I'm saying could be called class warfare. That's all right with me. I didn't start this war. This class war, you know, has been going on for some time with the elimination of the decent-paying manufacturing jobs this country used to have. It's gone on with the, you know, steady drumbeat of layoffs, even in good times, of white-collar people. And when you see that we had all this wealth built up at the top of the income spectrum, the wealth spectrum, and that it essentially was gambled away. You know, that it was put into crazy investments that we can't even understand now. You know, it's very hard for a layperson to understand some of these credit default swaps, et cetera. But certainly, yes, this class polarization has played a part in our present problems in many ways. But so I would strongly disagree with Kerry. I think we have to get money from somewhere as we face this national emergency. And one thing we could do is go back to taxing the rich. I don't think the people over 250,000 are my top priority right now.
Terry Neese, back to you. Your response.
Well, I think we're in a country where where the government. By the way, let me say that 159,000 jobs were lost in the private sector in September. The government hired 9,000 new people.
Okay.
That's an inversion to me. We should be hiring more people, not laying off, and the government should be laying off.
Why should the government be laying off?
Well, because the private sector can do more for the wealth in this country than the government can.
So you're suggesting then that private sector jobs generate wealth or are generated by it? How does that affect? What's the problem of hiring people to work in the government?
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm just saying that I personally believe that the private sector can garner much more wealth for this country than our government. And our government is we're a free market government. And should be a free market government. That's my opinion. So I believe that the government does not produce, government should not produce necessarily jobs. The private sector should be producing the jobs.
Barbara Ehrenreich, I know you need to leave us, so a final comment from you.
Yeah, that's a nice notion. The private sector should be generating jobs and good jobs, too. The private sector was supposed to be providing prosperity for us. The private sector, in its free market, unchained free market form that we've had in America in recent decades, did not do those things. It has failed. I think, I hope we pull out of this and that what I'm saying right now can be looked back on as rather extreme. But the way it looks to a lot of us today is that that kind of talk and that kind of faith in the private sector in free markets is what led us to the current crisis.
Barbara Ehrenreich, it's good to have had you with us, and thanks very much for being on our program.
My pleasure.
Author most recently, This Land is Their Land, reports from a divided nation. Back to Terry Neese, even Alan Greenspan said before the Congress recently that he was surprised that the private sector, if we can generalize, failed to protect itself and failed to act in its own interests. Is that an argument for more regulation?
I disagree with that. As a small business owner sitting out here in Oklahoma, I work every day to take a risk, and I'm proud of that in America, that I can take a risk, that I can hire more people, that I can make more money. I mean, that's what freedom and that's what America is all about. So I disagree strongly with what your previous guest said.
Okay.
I think the less government intervention we have, if you take taxes off my shoulder, you take paperwork and regulation off my shoulder, I will create more revenues for the private sector. I will create more revenues for our government to pave roads and provide the infrastructure that we need. As long as I have that kind of freedom in this country to build my business, and as I build my business, I build my country.
Let me go back to Jared Bernstein, a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. Once again, was with the Clinton administration, Labor Department. How is this argument going to play in Congress, and is it going to be different in the current Congress from what we'll see when the next Congress is seated next year, presumably with more Democrats?
Do you mean specifically the argument that Kerry was just making?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'll tell you, it's a very anachronistic argument. I mean, Kerry is kind of harking back to an argument that I think had much more currency 10 years ago, and in fact was an argument that was widely embraced by everyone from Alan Greenspan to, for that matter, members of the Clinton administration. I think she very clearly and well and then even passionately expressed a set of views about how economies work and don't work. The problem is that those views have really been discredited in the current context, and you know, sort of, as you mentioned, Greenspan was really very much the last ideologist to fall, and Carrie May, you know, absolutely has a right to reject that. But at least in terms of your question, Warren, those arguments simply don't have currency because we're looking at the impact, the result of pursuing that kind of philosophy, and we are in deep economic trouble now, and that's widely recognized. So the arguments that I'm making, that Barbara's making, have a lot more currency now.
I want to change the subject and talk a bit about the defense budget and whether there's money there. But Terry Neese, first of all, let me just give you an opportunity to respond. Do you feel that your voice at this point is not being heard?
No, I believe my voice is being heard. I talk with a lot of people around the country who agree. My voice is the voice of small business. And as I talk to small business owners all around the country, I understand what they're saying. They believe, as I believe, that if you let the free market work, then small business owners are the free market. We are the people who are out here creating the jobs. 98% of the jobs created last year from small business, and I'm very passionate about that. And by the way, I also believe that, you know, if you look at putting a stimulus package together in the next, say, 4 to 5 weeks, one of your guests was talking about the extension of unemployment, certainly needed, but we also need to help people with new training. We need to help them find the work that they are satisfied with and that they can feed their family with. And so extending the unemployment is certainly crucial, but it's also crucial to help them with new training and new education to find the jobs that are critical to feed their family.
Okay, let me go back to Jared Bernstein. Barney Frank, a very senior Democrat in the Congress, recently suggested that in order to provide money for a stimulus package, which would, I assume, probably would include new training, I don't think anybody's going to argue with the need for that, that perhaps 25% of the defense budget could be cut and transferred to other activities. Do you think, Jared Bernstein, based on your studies of the federal budget, that's possible?
Absolutely, and it's precisely based on my studies by the work of folks like Larry Korb, the Center for American Progress, other analysts who understand military technology a lot better than me. The problem is that military spending has been held harmless with the underlying assumption that anything the military spends on must be worthwhile. Now, I absolutely agree that we want to have the best military we can have and that we need, but it's obviously completely wrongheaded to just assume that if the military is spending it, it must be worth it and it must be efficient. And thankfully, some really smart analysts have been looking at this. When you hear John McCain, for example, say, "I'm going to freeze the federal budget except defense," embedded in that statement is an assumption anything that the Defense Department's spending it on is well spent. And as I said, there are good analysts who don't come into this with some sort of a political bias. It's not that they're against a strong military. It's that they want that money spent efficiently. So good for Barney.
Very quickly, I want to get another guest in here, but Senator McCain has in the past said that he does think that there are ways of paring the defense budget.
Well, that's true. That's a very important point.
Yeah, he may not have made that point in the comment just pointed to during this campaign. It's often been pointed out that the defense budget has got to the point, and I think Donald Rumsfeld said this, that you can't audit it, that it's too complicated, too difficult to that it's sort of grown in a way that nobody can get their hands around or get their mind around. Winslow Wheeler is director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information. He's author of America's Defense Meltdown, Pentagon Reform for the New President in Congress, which is due out next month. He formerly was National Security Advisor to both Republican and Democratic members of the U.S. Senate. Winslow Wheeler, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. It's nice to be with you again.
Can we cut? Would it be possible to cut anytime soon 25% of the defense budget and use the money for infrastructure projects or something else that is needed in this economic situation?
Yes. I think we need to get some perspective here. We now have the largest defense budget we've ever had since the end of World War II, with adjusting for inflation. We also happen to have the smallest army, the fewest combat ships, and the smallest number of combat fighters and bombers we've ever had since the end of World War II. Our inventory is on average older than it's been for the last several decades, and we're sending combat units into Iraq and Afghanistan with inadequate training. What I'm saying is that we are spending a huge amount of money historically, and we're getting very little for it. I have a lot of sympathy for what Barney Frank said and the work of people like Larry Korb, but I should also point out that Barney Frank is probably one of the worst people to say that, having just engineered a almost trillion-dollar bailout package for Wall Street, and then pointing to the part of the political spectrum that he's, you know, not associated with, say, you guys should help pay for this. It would have been much more helpful if somebody in the middle or the right of the political spectrum came out saying this.
So he may be right, but he's not the right guy to sell the point, is what you're saying.
Exactly, yes.
Well, why is it that we're spending bigger but getting less?
Decades of it's, the problem isn't so much waste, fraud, and abuse. Nobody knows what that amount is because it's quite literally unmeasurable. But it's bad decisions on the part of Democrats and Republicans in Congress for decades and decades. I once joked with a close friend of mine in the Pentagon towards the end of the Clinton administration that this couldn't possibly get any worse in terms of getting almost nothing for huge amounts of money. How wrong he and I were. This is a problem not created by George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, but they certainly made it a lot worse. We need to start thinking in quite different, fundamentally quite different ways about how to make decisions. We need to start enforcing accountability on these managers who are making bad decisions. We need to get objective, realistic estimates of what a program is likely to cost at the front end before the camel gets his nose under the tent. We need to hire managers who will not sell themselves to manufacturers after they leave the Pentagon. We need to think fundamentally about how we do these things, and then some of the decisions will start to fall out about which programs we don't need are irrelevant to warfare as we know it today, or promise the world but will deliver nothing.
When you talk about projects and describe them that way, often projects that have billion-dollar price tags attached to them, isn't part of the reason for that and part of the reason for all of the bad decisions that you're talking about that often these projects have subcontractors in practically every congressional district?
Sure. Congress is a huge part of the problem. This goes across both parties and all parts of the political spectrum. Porkers include Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, moderates, and so on. You can count on one hand the number of members of Congress who are in the faintest way interested in not engaging in huge amounts of pork each year. But it's not just that. It's that the preoccupation with pork in Capitol Hill kills oversight. You're not going to get your goodies approved by the Pentagon if you ask aggressive, informed questions in hearings. You're not going to get your pork project approved by the chairman of the committee like Ted Stevens if you wound some of his favorite projects or argue against them on the floor, or as his staff director always said to staff meetings, if you vote against our bill, don't expect us to be very helpful to you. There's a system on Capitol Hill that almost all people engaged in, are still engaging in, that helps to make these problems worse, not better.
So, Jared Bernstein, back to you now with the Economic Policy Institute. Much as all of us would like to get 25% out of the defense budget for other purposes, is it possible?
Well, you know, that was a sobering discussion you two had. But yes, I think it is possible. I think it's critical. I think what you're hearing, what I was at a meeting recently when Barney Frank made this point. It was a meeting of the Democratic House leadership. And I have to tell you that I've been in this town since the early 90s. I don't remember hearing anybody make that point so forcefully. I understand the kind of hurdles that were mentioned, but I also believe that with leadership, those hurdles can be jumped over. And I think obviously there's an election out there, and I think this is a critical issue regarding who people choose to send to president and to the Congress. This ought to be an election year issue, and if so, with the kind of leadership we need, I believe we could make these changes.
Okay, I think what we're doing here is setting up a program for the very near future, as soon as the election itself is over, and we hope to take this issue up again at that time. I want to thank you all for being with us, Jared Bernstein with the Center for Economic Policy Institute, Winslow Wheeler with the Center for Defense Information, Terry Neese at the National Center for Policy Analysis, Barbara Ehrenreich, and Bernard Simon, our earlier guests as well. Good to have you all with us.